You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Mac toku ingoa, no mai hari mai, ki te wire mo tēnei rā. Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for Tuesday the 31st of January. I'm joined here by my producer Sam Smith.
Hi Mac, how's it going?
It's going great, thanks. And coming up on the show today, we'll be discussing the latest occurrences on the Trump side of things, with the closing of America's borders to 7 Muslim-majority countries. The president of New Zealand's Federation of Islamic Associations will also be talking about what this ban means for Kiwis. We'll have our weekly chat with Māori Party co-leader Marama Fox on all things Trump and negotiations of the Resource Management Act. We talk with Victoria University academic about her new book, which looks at the first 10 years of Māori TV. And we'll have Green Desk with Lily Peacock, and this week she speaks to one of the organisers of Auckland's Kalmana Gardens. If you want to let us know your thoughts on any issues we cover, please give us a call on 309 3879 or a text on 5395. But first up on the show, we have a special report on Sunday's State of the Nation Address, hosted by the Greens and Labour.
The Wire.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
Right. Well, on Sunday, Labour and the Greens hosted their joint State of the Nation Address in Mount Albert. I went along to check it out, and I filed this report. Last Sunday, the Greens and Labour held a joint State of the Nation Address in Mount Albert. This was the first time the two parties had held their State of the Nation events together. Speaking to a packed hall of party faithful, Labour leader Andrew Little and Greens co-leader Metiria Tude outlined what they thought was wrong with the country as we head into an election later in the year. First up was Metiria Tude, who started by talking about her biggest inspiration, Fierce Women.
I want to talk to you today about one of my greatest inspirations, Mana Wahine. Who protect and care for our people and our environment, for our rights and our planet, my mother and my daughter. It is the fierce women, the mana wahine in this room, who inspire and who motivate me and James and all of us in the Green Party, Aotearoa New Zealand. You know, when I became a mum and I first held my baby in my arms, I realised then that the work of those fierce women who had gone before, Nene Waitirangi, Hank Tepe, all of those fierce women, it was a long way from finished, their work. They worked for the equality of women, for Pākehā and Māori women, for their safety, for their right to dignity and respect. It's what we want for all our kids. It's what I want for my daughter. I'm sure it's what you want for yours, your daughters and your sons too. We want our kids to be treated well, and that is the country that we are all here working to create.
Tude then outlined what the Green Party thinks is wrong with New Zealand currently, focusing on things such as dirty rivers and the housing crisis.
We still live in a country where there are too many who live in substandard homes, or in no homes at all, actually, where many have no jobs, or are trapped in low-paid jobs that don't provide for them and their families. We have 150,000 children in this country go without milk and meat and veggies. Where third-world diseases are rampant. We have chronic lung disease 7 times the average of most other developed countries. Shame. It is a New Zealand where our rivers and our lakes and beaches are not clean enough for us to swim in, where some can't even trust the water that comes out of their taps, where the government won't stop or even prepare for climate change.
Tude finished her speech by looking at National's performance in government, saying that Bill English is a Prime Minister that does things that are easy but not always right.
Now we have a new Prime Minister who believes that government can do no more.
A Prime Minister who won't end poverty. A Prime Minister who is the architect of New Zealand's housing crisis. A Prime Minister who accepts locking out an entire generation from warm, safe and affordable housing. What we have learned from National in the past 9 years is that they might do what is easy, but they will not do what is right. The Green Party will do what is right, even when it's not easy.
Next up on the speaking platform was Labour leader Andrew Little. He began by talking about his son and how he fears his son's generation might not be able to own their own home.
You know, my son Cam turns 16 this year. Every weekend I cannot get along to watch Cam and his mates doing their Saturday rugby, usually embraced by a gentle Wellington southerly. But I look at Cam and his mates, you know, they're smart kids. They're creative, determined, they're courageous. You see in the way they do their home, you see what they do for their home. You know, for his generation, there are no limits. They're going to do great things with their lives, I can see it in them now. A few short years, Cam and his generation will chart their direction for our country. You know, they own New Zealand's future, but right now, there's a good chance that none of them will ever own their own home. And that's wrong. And that's wrong.
Little then took the opportunity to address Donald Trump and the rise of racism and the far right around the world, saying New Zealand can be a leader for tolerance and acceptance.
You know, looking around the world right now, President Trump in the United States, the far right of Europe, holding on to a positive, inclusive vision is more important now than ever. We're seeing shocking scenes in the US as Donald Trump moves to turn away refugees fleeing persecution from their own countries. I'm telling you now, I will never do that here, never. The places that used to light the world with their progressive thinking, their lights are shining more dimly now. So let us never loosen our hold on the things that define who we are in this great country. You know, we can set the standard for cooperation, for tolerance, for a government that governs with compassion. We can show there's a better path than isolation and bigotry. It's our turn to shine.
Little then concluded his speech by looking forward to the next election and attacked National and Bill English for their failure to address the issues New Zealand currently faces.
So it is game on in this election. And our campaign starts here, today, with this joint State of the Nation event. And you know what? This year's election really matters. Every day that National governs, the Kiwi dream slips further away from more and more people. Bill English has to take responsibility. You know what? He was around that cabinet table for every decision that's taken money out of schools, that's taken money off the hospitals, that's put a lid on our police numbers at a time of a rising population. He's been there for every one of those decisions. He's ignored the housing crisis. And at a time of 41,000 people homeless, he's the one actively selling our state houses. National is out of ideas, and they're out of touch. They've got nothing new to offer. And Bill English said it this week. He said, we've reached the limits of what government can do. Really? Really? Now, it's very clear what that means. Every year that National remains in office, the dream of home ownership slips away from thousands more young couples. Every year that National remains in office, 45,000 more people who need treatment won't get it. Every year National remains in office, our schools will slide further down the world rankings. It's not good enough. Not for our kids, not for our country.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
That was Sam Smith's report on the weekend's events for the Labour and Greens Party at the State of the Nation. Now, the latest of President Trump's executive orders has sparked a great deal of unrest, and to provide some background to the current situation, I filed this report. On Friday, Donald Trump signed an executive order which restricted America's border, namely through a temporary 90-day ban on those from seven Muslim-majority countries: Iraq, Syria, Iran, Yemen, Sudan, Libya, and Somalia. Trump stressed that this was not a Muslim ban, but also said he would prioritize Christian refugees in the future. On Saturday, he seemed confident the executive order was panning out.
It's working out very nicely. You see it at the airports, you see it all over. It's working out very nicely, and we're going to have a very, very strict ban, and we're going to have extreme vetting, which we should have had in this country for many years.
But just how nicely did it work out?
No hate, no fear. Immigrants are welcome here. Say it loud, say it clear. Refugees are welcome here.
Thousands of protesters arrived at John F. Kennedy Airport in New York on Sunday in condemnation of what was now very much known as the Muslim ban. With an array of chants, they called for an end to the executive order, as well as freedom for those being detained at airports across the country. Inside was just as chaotic, with border protection agents and immigration officials unsure of how to interpret the new marching orders, especially with lawyers now closing in on all sides. But then came a victory for the protesters. After a lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union resulted in a court ruling granting a stay on any deportations of detainees, ACLU Executive Director Anthony D. Romero told those outside the courthouse that it was a victory for the American Constitution.
This was a remarkable day. What we've shown today is that the courts can work. They are a bulwark in our democracy. And when President Trump enacts laws or executive orders that are unconstitutional and illegal, the courts are there to defend everyone's rights. So we want to thank you very, very much.
However, for those not already in America, this stay will mean very little. For BFM News, Cormac Smith, Tene.
Can anyone explain why the modern-day whales are so big?
The Wire.
But what does all of this mean for New Zealanders? Are our rights also being infringed on? Well, this now becomes a question of whether dual citizens are affected by the executive order or not, and on this there is some confusion. To give you an idea of the scale of people that might be affected by this, of the seven countries covered by the ban, at least Iraq, Iran, Syria, Sudan, and Somalia allow for dual citizenship. And between 1999 and 2014, New Zealand granted citizenship to over 13,000 people from those countries. Now, not all of these have necessarily retained dual citizenship, of course, but nonetheless, it is a staggering figure. Here's where it gets confusing. The US State Department issued a statement on Sunday saying dual citizens would fall under the same restrictions as nationals and therefore be barred from entering the US. However, following conversations between Boris Johnson and Donald Trump, the British Foreign Office stated that UK dual citizens will be exempt from the ban so long as they are not travelling to the US from one of the seven countries. And a spokesperson for Justin Trudeau revealed that Canadian dual citizens will not have their travel impeded on either. So considering the official State Department line suggests a one rule for all, this appears to be a complete contradiction of the executive order. And going back to New Zealand, while Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade confirms that Australian dual citizens are included in this ban, New Zealand's counterpart has done no such thing. Instead, the ministry has directed people to the US Embassy and Consulate in Auckland, who have provided the original and potentially superficial State Department line. So at this point, it's not really clear at all whether New Zealanders are caught up in this ban. And for more on this topic, I spoke to Hazim Arafair, who is the president of the Federation of Islamic Associations of New Zealand. And I began by asking what the implications of this executive order are for Muslims.
Well, basically, it's as we have said in the past, this is a discriminatory policy, and it's against Muslims. It's a ban on Muslims, and indeed, it is a threat to Muslims around the world who wants to go to the States to do any of their life businesses there, or wants to live there, or seek further education. It's a It is really discriminatory.
Right. And how much of an impact do you think this is going to have on New Zealand's Muslim community?
Well, there's a fair bit of Muslim community in New Zealand who's got a lot of ties in the States. And just because they've been born in one of the seven banned countries, they just simply won't be allowed. They won't be allowed to go and to go to the States to pursue any of their wishes there, whether it was work or research purposes or just visiting friends and family.
And there will be a lot of these people living in New Zealand with this kind of dual citizenship.
There is a few of them, yes, correct. And based on this policy, they won't be allowed to enter the States.
What would you like to see from the New Zealand government in terms of a response to this? Is there anything you can do, or we can do, do you think?
I'd like to commend the Honourable Bill English for his decision on this and for his comments on this. I think pretty much the New Zealand government has done the best that they can. They have expressed the New Zealand government has expressed their rejection to such policy and has reassured us that this policy won't happen here. And to the best of what we know, this is the best that the government that can actually do in such a situation. They simply just cannot go and tell the Americans how to run their country.
It's interesting you say that, because a lot of people criticized Bill English for not taking a very strong stance on this and not necessarily condemning America's actions, but rather saying New Zealand itself would not take those. But you feel that's an adequate line?
No, we don't, because really neither New Zealand nor any other country can actually tell America what to do. It's their country, it's their policy. We strongly condemn this policy, but we don't think that the New Zealand government could have done anything more to condemn this policy.
What do you make of the countries that have been targeted in this specifically? Obviously, there are many Muslim-majority countries, but why do you think these seven in particular have been chosen?
I've been asking this question for quite some time, obviously, and of course I don't have any hard fact answers. All what we've been told that there are countries in which the American president thinks that there are countries that promote terrorism or harbor terrorism. That's why he made his decision about these seven countries.
How do you think it affects the perception of terrorism in relation to Muslims?
Well, the reason why we said that it's a discriminatory decision, it's because it discriminates against Muslims. And you see, Muslims are way more than these seven countries. What is also important to mention that terrorism has got no religion, and terrorism is found in those countries with, you know, the percentage of terrorists in these countries is just extremely minute compared to the majority or to the major population of all of these countries. And that's why we've been tarnished with the same, you know, with the same we've been blamed for the actions of minority. And that's why it's labeling the whole Muslims and all Islam by being terrorists.
Is there much of a reaction from people here in New Zealand to these events?
Muslims and non-Muslims in New Zealand are absolutely outraged with this decision. We keep getting letters of support. One of our mosques in Wellington has been actually getting a lot of support messages and getting bunches of flowers all day yesterday, as kind of expression of the rejection of such a policy.
This is the fucking news.
The Wire.
That was President of the Federation of Islamic Associations of New Zealand, Hazim Arafir, speaking about the implications of Trump's ban on Muslims. After the break, we'll be speaking to Māori Party co-leader Marama Fox. But for now, here is Spring Has Sprung by Skeggs.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Next up is our regular chat with Māori Party co-leader Marama Fox. This week I asked her about Trump's Muslim ban, immigration policy and trouble with the Resource Management Act.
It's remarkable. I was thinking last night that, you ban a whole group of people because of fear and insecurity. And then you start to normalise that in society. So that's happened before. And last night I was thinking, oh, what will he do next? Make them wear a symbol, something to identify them easily so that we can tell who they are and whether or not they can travel or go to the same places as everybody else. I mean, that's happened before. And before it was a star, they might want to start making people wear a crescent or something so that they can be identified easily. I mean, it just is ridiculous. And I'm just am lost for words, really.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely a lot of similarities, I guess, to earlier kind of plights. There was a lot of outrage over Bill English's silence on this issue, although he later came out saying that it was not a policy he agreed with personally or think New Zealand should have. But do you think we as a country and our government needs to take a stronger stance on this issue?
I mean, every single day there is something outrageous that comes out of that administration. Every single day. And people have said to me, Marama, are you going to release a statement about his treatment of women? Or are you going to release a statement about this and that? I'm thinking, oh my gosh, where would we stop? Because it just keeps going and going. And he's been elected as president of the country, and the moves that he is making are just astounding to most people. So as a country, we should and could stand up for the injustice as we see it. And obviously that can happen with... I think that it just seems to be so difficult because there is so much to object to. So, you know, we start just... write them off altogether. What would the statement say? I mean, that's my issue. When people say to me, why are you not making a statement? I say, well, where do you start? And every single day we'd have to make another one.
Right. I guess most people just see not speaking out on this issue as kind of letting it slide. I mean, do you think there's also the element that you just don't want to piss your neighbours off in this case? Do you think that it's important to preserve relations with the US? Or?
Oh, Jane goes, I mean, it's very difficult. I mean, seriously, but it's because there are people in the country, obviously, you still want to have relationships with. It's not that the administration doesn't reflect the view of the entire population, and so you don't write off the whole of Australia for the dumb things that one of their politicians does. Although, you know, they're passing these laws, I can imagine that within America itself, people are mobilising, as we've seen, and we support their action to do so. I mean, Bill English has come out. I think they're playing a watching game as well. I mean, I haven't spoken to him, but if you're going to come out, is what exactly do you say? America, you're dumb. Or Donald Trump, that's ridiculous. And so he's already cut everybody else off. He's looking out for America. There's not much more damage you can do, really. So he may as well say what needs to be said. But making statements like that and condemning that practice, I mean, that's one thing. Do you then take sanctions against a country like they did against South Africa when they were doing ridiculous things with their people? I mean, if we start talking about sanctions, what about Indonesia? When are we going to have sanctions against them? we were going to hear somebody speak out again about that. There are so many things. So I think, yes, there is obviously room, but at this moment, for me at least, I'd be wondering where to start because there seems to be so much to object to.
Outside of calling them out, how would you deal with the fallout from this in terms of migration and refugees? I noticed there's no immigration policy on your website, but I imagine you have one, and the Maori Party has one nonetheless. Does it include doubling the refugee quota, or?
We've already supported doubling the refugee quota last time that happened. Last time we called for that, our policy is about manaakitanga. So that's our constitution of the values. So we want to be able to look after the people who live within our borders, and look after those that come to our country, and that means all of us. So some of the issues we have is the treatment or the equitable treatment of the people who live in the country. And so while we can double the refugee numbers, we need to be able to look after them. We need to be able to ensure that they are adequately housed. And if we're making sure that we can do that for refugees, we also need to do that for the citizens of Aotearoa, making sure that they are adequately catered for, that they're adequately housed, that they have the opportunity for employment, that children are able to go to quality schools and be treated with equity. And so there are a number of things that we talk about. As far as immigration goes, manaakitanga has always been our policy to ensure that they're cared for along with everyone else in our country.
And just moving along, a group of local authorities supporting GE Free have got together in a call-in for the Māori Party to oppose reform to the Resource Management Act, which would take away their abilities to create these GE Free zones. You're in support of this call, are you?
Yeah, of course we are. What we're in support of is the ability for regions to have GE Free zones. We're also in support of the negotiations and the changes that we've been able to make to the current draft of the RMA, which is to have mana whakahono arrangements with local councils and iwi groups to ensure that kaitiaki tanga is recognised in the law around the way we look after our land and our rivers. So there are a number of good things that we've been able to push and ensure happen within the RMA. So here is the issue. We do not agree with the 360D provisions in the RMA, and we significantly cut those back. Though we agreed the policy subject to drafting, and now that we've seen the drafting, there are a number of things that we have concerns about. And when we go back to government, we will continue to negotiate with the minister. To simply walk away from the RMA reforms will mean that the government will go and find support from someone else. That someone else would be New Zealand First, and New Zealand First have promised to strip every provision in regards to the treaty and tikanga Māori and the ability of iwi to have a say, anything that has anything to do with culture, to be stripped out of the RMA. So it's sometimes the devil you know or the devil you don't. We don't agree that the government should be limiting regions' ability to have GE free zones, and we'll continue to make that known to the government. We did say that we would support the changes to the RMA subject to drafting. That's not something we agree with. We'll go back and talk to the government. We wouldn't simply walk away from it until we're exhausted every opportunity and every measure and every ability to negotiate with them to make the changes. So otherwise, they'll just push them through and they'll go somewhere else and they'll rip out all the other good stuff that we've been able to get in there.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
That was Māori Party co-leader Marama Fox speaking to me earlier this morning. It's 36 minutes past 12. If you have any thoughts or feelings to share about the show today, you can give us a call on 309-3879 or a text on 5395. Next up is The Green Desk with Lily Peacock.
Please welcome Lily Peacock for The Green Desk.
Today we're speaking with Adrian Roche, the garden manager of the Kamana Organic Gardens. The gardens have recently been redeveloped as an organic demonstration garden and resource for sustainability education. Hello Adrian, how are you going today?
I'm good, Louise, thank you. Yes, how are you?
Yeah, pretty good. Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit of history about the Kamana Gardens?
It was set up in 1981 by a man called Paul Lagerstedt, who wanted to demonstrate to people what could be done on in urban agriculture. So it's been going for 35, 36 years. Before that, it was a farm owned by a order of nuns called the Sisters of Compassion. So they used to farm this land. So it's got a long history of food production, really.
Was that the nunnery that was recently bought and converted that's on the corner there of Kalmana and Hokanui?
Yeah. I mean, it was the Catholic Church. They sold this land to the council in the very early 80s. But it's the land on the corner of... it was all developed about 10 years ago.
Ah, interesting. And what brought on the recent redevelopment? Because you went from having a sort of trustee for mental support to being a more open community garden?
That's right. We used to, for 22 years, we had funding as a mental health program run by Framework Trust. So this land is council land, and it's leased by a group of local people called the Kalmana Gardens Trust.
Mm-hmm.
They used to sublease it to Framework Trust, who's a big community mental health provider. So the Framework was here for 22 years, and they pulled out 2 years ago. So we've sort of had to go through have a rethink about what we're doing and how we're going to make the place work. And so the Kalmana Trust committed to keeping it as a place of education and also a therapeutic space. So we're still supporting the mental health community and people who need support and being here for a place of education. And as you say, we're opening it up more to the community. It always has been open to the community, but we're now very reliant on the community to support us.
Yeah, so you're sort of seeking out a little bit more of that community touch.
Yeah. I mean, our whole reason to be here is to teach the community and support the community in growing food and sustainability in general. But we also need support from the community.
Yeah, so speaking of that sustainable resource education, what programs do you offer to the community that they can engage with in terms of talking about sustainability?
I guess step one is the place is always open, so people can always sort of wander through and have a look. And we offer sort of tours, so people can come through for a guided tour.
Mm-hmm.
People can always just come in and have a chat to me or any of the other gardeners and ask for advice. We are always trying to set up workshop programs. We've got a plum making... what exactly is it? It's some sort of special Chinese plum... jam workshop happening
Umami? Is that what that is?
All right, tell me what it is. I've been away on holiday for a couple of weeks.
Is it umami? That's like a plum fermented paste or something?
Did I say Japanese or Chinese?
Japanese.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, no, it's not that. It's a Chinese thing. It's on the, you have to look on our website, so it's on Saturday the 18th.
Is it on the What's On page?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So going off that again, you've got some projects coming up. Is that teamed up with other people? Like, I know you've done quite a few things with Orphan's Kitchen, and I always see them in their truck coming down on a Tuesday morning.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they've just been here this morning. Well, we're having a big festival here on March the 26th.
Oh, that's exciting.
So that's a big sort of open day, and we'll have workshops there, and Orphan's Kitchen will be doing something, I'm not sure, probably a big barbecue.
They did a hangi last year, was it?
Yeah,
it smelled so good.
Yeah, they've done a hangi and a big barbecue. Yeah, it was really amazing the way... So we've had two, and they've been really successful. And the last one, we did one in autumn last year, and it was a pretty crappy day. It was quite wet, but still 1,000 people came through.
1,000?
Like, yeah.
Through the gardens?
Yeah.
And nothing got trampled?
No. Well, we used the paddock, so we've got the paddock.
Oh, right.
Excuse me. They've got paddocks as well. So, yeah, that was amazing because it was like, wow, the people know about us and like us because they've come in this crappy weather. So that's a good fundraiser for us. And just to showcase the gardens and, you know, get people to know it's here and get them to sort of go, oh, wow, this is a community asset and they can, you know, get involved. And
so other than the events that you've got coming up through summer and through the year and you've got the workshops, if somebody was like, oh, I want to learn how to garden organically or I don't know where to begin, they could come to you for advice?
Yeah. So I'm here Monday to Friday as the garden manager.
Yeah.
It's a little bit more problematic for us on the weekends. We're sort of trying to be open from 10 to 1 on Saturdays.
Mm.
So people can come along then. Ideally, they come along Monday to Friday. We are trying to get ourselves more organised for weekends because obviously that's when most people are available.
But that's hard because you're all kind of run on volunteer basis, aren't you?
Yeah. So I'm paid as the garden manager, and then everyone else is volunteers. And so, to organise volunteers takes quite a lot of effort. But we love having volunteers here, and we always want people to come here and help us garden because it's a big place. And
can I volunteer in exchange for seeds and or vegetables?
Shush. Yep. We always feed our volunteers. So. Like, for example, we grow lots of potatoes, but we don't sell them. We feed the volunteers with them.
I love potatoes.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's pretty amazing sitting down to lunch and you can look out at the gardens and go, hey, wow, those potatoes are growing just out there.
You know what I love is the cows.
And the cows.
The cows are so cute.
Yeah, you can't eat those.
No, I don't want to eat those. My dog was barking at them the other day, and it was funny because he's a farm dog, and I was like, why are you barking at the cows? Because you're a farm dog.
He's afraid
of them.
We had a terrible incident recently with a dog. A dog attacked our pony.
What? Not Jaffa.
Jaffa got attacked by a Rottweiler.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah.
Is that why you guys don't allow dogs in there anymore?
Yeah.
Right, yeah, no, good call.
Yeah.
Okay, my last question for today is, what's the best way to start organic gardening?
The best way to start? Well, I mean, it's just planting in the ground, so get some soil, bare soil, and start planting. So usually it means getting rid of whatever's there first.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be weeds, or you might even have to chop out the odd tree. But it's a fairly simple exercise. It's just get some soil prepared and start planting. And just make sure you have a read about, what you're going to plant. So like every plant, every vegetable's got a unique story. So like a tomato is different from a potato, is different from a courgette.
Of course, yeah.
So have a little read about it first, because it's terrible if you sort of, there's two simple mistakes that people make is they plant in the wrong season and they don't get the spacing right. So like, you know, if you read about tomatoes, you get all excited and they go, oh, can't plant them now.
Yeah, of course. So don't plant for the season.
Yeah, don't make those dumb mistakes. And also people squeeze things in too much.
Yeah.
So you can squeeze things in, but there's, you know, plants do need a certain amount of space and they all have slightly different spacings. But I think there's, I mean, and you know, you always, so you just get planting. Don't worry too much about edges and stuff like that. Just start planting and always try and improve your soil and, just do it.
Come down and have a chat to you at the Kamana Organic Gardens if you get stuck.
yeah, that'd be great.
That was the Green Desk.
Yes, that was the Green Desk, which had Lily Peacock this week speaking to Adrian Roche, who is the garden manager of Kalmana Gardens. After the break, we'll have our last segment on the show.
Hurry, wake up! I think I hear noises!
Oh, it's probably just the cats. They have soccer in the morning.
Oh, yeah.
Wait a minute! Our cats are dead!
Morning, you lovebirds!
Great to see you guys. I think you might like some smashed avo on toast.
Aww. Hannah, honestly, you're too much.
Mm.
How'd you get in this time?
How about a heaping bowl of guacamole? Yeah, come on.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Mornings.
Weekday mornings from 7. Wake up and smell the bee with your kindly friend, Hannah. BFM Breakfast is the parsley sprig on your scrambled morning. The snap, crackle and pop Rice Krispies in your plain old bowl of life. BFM Breakfast. Weekdays from 7 till 10. Proudly brought to you by Orcon, the meanest ISP with broadband and fibre and all that other internet stuff at orcon.net.nz.
Hello, Hannah.
they are nicking our shit. They totally are.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. Next up, we have Sam Smith with a report on Māori TV history.
Thanks, Mac. Yes, Victoria University Associate Professor in Media Studies Joe Smith has just published a new book looking at the history of Māori television. The book titled Māori Television, The First 10 Years, shines a light on the complex dynamics underpinning state-funded Māori media. In the process, it also offers 5 frameworks to help understand Māori television as an organisation and how it operates within a wider non-Māori context. Earlier, I spoke to Smith, and I began by asking her what she explores in the book.
The book is based on research conducted between 2012 and 2015, where I interviewed Māori TV staff and Māori media commentators and academics and language advocates, as well as audiences. I did that in order to get a sense of how Māori TV has managed its conflicting objectives to promote and protect language and culture for the revitalisation of te reo Māori tikanga, to also appeal to a broad audience and to also provide an entertaining and educated television. So that kind of objective that Māori TV has to meet under its legislation in 2003, I thought was quite a complex array of challenges, and I wanted to find out how they actually manage that. So their book offers 5 different frameworks for thinking about Māori TV. It argues that it's more than simply a media organisation, it's also a language learning organisation. So it's basically a toolkit. The book is a toolkit for understanding the complexities of Māori TV.
Now, you say in the book that Māori TV was originally set up to protect and promote te reo Māori, ngā tikanga Māori, to inform, educate and entertain, and thus to enrich New Zealand society, culture and heritage. Do you think overall it has managed to achieve these things?
Yeah, I think the, as I said, those challenges are really, really large ones for a television organisation to meet. And if you think about the decades of Crown neglect in relation to te reo Māori and its obligations under the Tiriti of Waitangi, Māori TV is charged with a whole lot of responsibilities that perhaps should be, you know, carried more generally in other sectors of society, including the education sector. So if you think about the effectiveness of Māori TV and language and cultural uplift, I think it's been an invaluable tool. I think that we need to take a longitudinal attitude to it too. We can't just, gauge its effectiveness in the first 10 years. And the book is simply a snapshot of that first 10 years too, just to give audiences and readers an idea of the complexities and challenges faced by the organisation. But I do think it has been an invaluable tool to complement other sectors, and other language organisations.
How difficult do you think it's been for Māori TV to operate within what is largely a non-Māori broadcast environment?
There are quite a few challenges to work with minority media forms such as te reo in a pervasively monolingual English dominant culture. New Zealand society is incredibly monolingual. And so in the first instance, you have to deal with the language question. How do you actually popularise and make informative, entertaining, good-looking television, good-sounding TV using a minority language? So that's the first challenge when everyone's so used to, speaking in English. And the second challenge, I think, is that we understand media historically, and those people who have made media have been global media makers. So what we think is good-looking TV or good-looking or good-sounding radio or good-looking film are kind of like the result of norms established by non-Māori media makers, not just Pākehā, but more globally. And New Zealand's media has been deeply influenced by the UK and the US, and it continues to be influenced by these global norms. So I think it's an incredible challenge for Māori media makers to make good-looking Māori media that also honours the integrity of Māori culture.
Hmm. Do you think Māori TV has managed to address some of the problems around getting Māori stories into the media and having Māori voices tell those stories?
So, yeah, there's been a great increase in terms of the amount of Māori news stories on television due to Māori TV's establishment, but there is still a great need for more Māori in the industry and also for more culturally literate non-Māori journalists, I think, you know. So it's the burden or the kind of the opportunities of understanding things from a Māori perspective are also opportunities that should be taken up by non-Māori journalists, I think, in order to help invigorate New Zealand's news media cultures.
What about the role the channel has played in exposing Pākehā audiences to te reo and Māori culture? How important has this been?
So a lot of the feedback that we got in the interviews and from focus groups talked about the amazing function that Māori TV has. It's a cultural bridge to non-Māori to understand or to share understanding and to expand non-Māori understandings of how, you know, iwi work, how history of particular places are, what kinds of practices occur throughout the country by Māori. So it's certainly been a really big cultural bridge for increasing and enhancing the understanding of things Māori in this country. But we still have a long way to go in terms of really getting to grips with how the norms of Māori culture can become the norms of New Zealand culture.
Mm-hmm. Now, moving forward, given the media climate we live in, particularly with commercialisation and integration of media companies, do you think Māori TV's public broadcast status is under threat?
Well, I really, in the book, I take a issue, I think, with those who call Māori TV public service TV. It certainly is, you know, educative, informative television in that mode. But most importantly, we have to remember that Māori TV is the result of treaty-based activism.
Yep.
So its status is much more than simply that. It's a public service media provider. It's actually a taonga. It's a treasure.
Mm.
So it's also another example of how Māori activism has benefited the nation as a whole in general too, because Māori TV is probably one of the very few providers in the New Zealand media landscape of international art house cinema, documentaries, informative and, you know, marginal kind of points of view. They've been portrayed on Māori TV for the benefit of the nation, and as such, they're a treasure.
So just finally, how essential is it then that Māori TV continues to survive and thrive and expand even into the future?
Oh, I think it's really, really important that we have as much diversity in our media scapes as possible. We can see today in the dominance of, you know, global media outlets and those corporations that kind of saturate our minds, that, you know, kind of occupy our attention. Is a whole kind of commercial pervasiveness that needs to be pushed against. So Māori TV offers one of the very few pockets of quality, informative, educated television, and its diversity and its ability to help set Māori agendas within the national and international media scapes is a crucial, it's a crucial public good, really, and a key aspect of what it means to be a citizen of Aotearoa, I think.
That was The Wire.
And that's the end of our show for another week. Thanks to Hazim Arafir, Marama Fox, Adrian Roche and Joe Smith for coming on the show today. And a big thanks to Lily Peacock for the Green Desk and to my producer Sam Smith for helping me put it all together. And of course, thank you to all of you listeners for tuning into The Wire this week. We'll be back again next Tuesday. Jen is up next with the 1-4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.